both of them. Not surprisingly, her injury and the blood in her face only accentuated her beauty, making her appear more fragile and therefore more precious. Julie was beautiful, although Bobby realized that she appeared more so in his eyes than to others, which was all right because, after all, his eyes were the only ones through which he could look at her. Though it was kinking up a bit now, in the moist night, her chestnut-brown hair was usually thick and lustrous. She had wide-set eyes as dark as semi-sweet chocolate, skin as smooth and naturally tan as toffee ice cream, and a generous mouth that always tasted sweet to him. Whenever he watched her, without her being fully aware of the intensity of his attention, or when he was apart from her and tried to conjure an image of her in his mind, he always thought of her in terms of food: chestnuts, chocolate, toffee, cream, sugar, butter. He found this amusing, but he also understood the profundity of his choice of similes. She reminded him of food because she, more than food, sustained him. Activity at the entrance to Decadine, about 60 feet away, at the end of the palm-flanked walkway, drew Julie's attention, and then Bobby's. Someone from the SWAT team had come to the doors to report to the guard stationed there. A moment later, one of the officers motioned for Julie and Bobby to come forward. When they joined him, he said, "They found this Rasmussen. You want to see him? Make sure he has the right diskettes?" "Yeah," Bobby said. "Definitely," Julie said, and her throaty voice didn't sound at all sexy now, just tough.
Keeping a lookout for any Laguna Beach police who might be running graveyard shift patrols, Frank Pollard removed the bundles of cash from the flight bag and piled them on the seat beside him. He counted 15 packets of $20 bills and 11 bundles of hundreds. He judged the thickness of each wad to be approximately 100 bills, and when he did the mathematics in his head, he came up with $140,000. He had no idea where the money had come from, or whether it belonged to him. The first of two small zippered side compartments in the bag yielded another surprise: a wallet that contained no cash and no credit cards, but two important pieces of identification: a Social Security card and a California driver's license. With the wallet was a United States passport. The photographs on the passport and license were of the same man: 30-ish, brown hair, a round face, prominent ears, brown eyes, an easy smile, and dimples. Realizing he had also forgotten what he looked like, he tilted the rearview mirror and was able to see enough of his face to match it with the one on the ID. The problem was, the license and passport bore the name James Roman, not Frank Pollard. He unzipped the second of the two smaller compartments and found another Social Security card, passport, and California driver's license. These were all in the name of George Ferris, but the photos were of Frank. James Roman meant nothing to him. George Ferris was also meaningless, and Frank Pollard, whom he believed himself to be, was only a cipher, a man without any past that he could recall. "What the hell am I tangled up in?" he said aloud. He needed to hear his own voice to convince himself that he was, in fact, not just a ghost, reluctant to leave this world for the one to which death had entitled him. As the fog closed around his parked car, blotting out most of the night beyond, a terrible loneliness overcame him. He could think of no one to whom he could turn, nowhere to which he could retreat and be assured of safety. A man without a past was also a man without a future.
When Bobby and Julie stepped out of the elevator onto the third floor, in the company of a police officer named McGrath, Julie saw Tom Rasmussen sitting on the polished gray vinyl tiles, his back against the wall of the corridor, his hands cuffed in front of him and linked by a length of chain to shackles that bound his ankles together. He was pouting. He had tried to steal software worth tens of millions of dollars, if not hundreds of millions, and from the window of Aykroyd's office he had cold-bloodedly given the signal to have Bobby killed, yet here he was pouting like a child because he'd been caught. His weasel face was puckered, and his lower lip was thrust out, and his yellow-brown eyes looked watery, as though he might break into tears if anyone dared to say a cross word. The mere sight of him infuriated Julie. She wanted to kick his teeth down his throat all the way into his stomach so he could re-chew whatever he'd last eaten. The cops had found him in a supply closet behind boxes that he had arranged to make a pitifully obvious hiding place. Evidently, standing at Aykroyd's window to watch the fireworks, he'd been surprised when Julie had appeared in the Toyota. She had driven the Toyota into the Decadine parking lot early in the day and had stayed far back from the building, in the shadows beneath the boughs of the laurel, where no one had spotted her. Instead of fleeing the moment he saw the first gunman run down, Rasmussen had hesitated, no doubt wondering who else was out there. Then he heard the sirens, and his only option was to hide out in the hope they would only search the building casually and conclude that he had escaped. With a computer, he was a genius. But when it came to making cool decisions under fire, Rasmussen was not half as bright as he thought he was. Two heavily armed cops were watching over him, but because he was huddled and shivering and on the verge of tears, they were a bit ludicrous in their bulletproof vests, cradling automatic weapons, squinting in the fluorescent glare and looking grim. Julie knew one of the officers, Samson Garfus, from her own days with the Sheriff's Department, where Samson also served before joining the City of Irvine force. Either his parents had been prescient, or he had striven mightily to live up to his name, for he was both tall and broad and rock-like. He held a lidless box that contained four small floppy diskettes. He showed it to Julie and said, "Is this what he was after?" "Could be," she said, accepting the box. Taking the diskettes from her, Bobby said, "I'll have to go down one floor to Aykroyd's office, switch on the computer, pop these in, and see what's on them." "Go ahead," Samson said. "Well, you'll have to accompany me," Bobby said to McGrath, the officer who had brought them up in the elevator. "Keep a watch on me. Make sure I don't tamper with these things." He indicated Tom Rasmussen. "We don't want this piece of slime claiming they were blank disks, saying I framed him by copying the real stuff onto them myself." As Bobby and McGrath went into one of the elevators and descended to the second floor, Julie hunkered down in front of Rasmussen. "You know who I am?" Rasmussen looked at her and said nothing. "I'm Bobby Dakota's wife." "Bobby was in the van your goons shot up. It was my Bobby you tried to kill." He looked away from her, at his cuffed wrists. She said, "Know what I'd like to do to you?" She held one of her hands down in front of his face and wiggled her manicured nails. "For starters, I'd like to grab you by the throat, hold your head against the wall, and ram two of these nice sharp fingernails straight through your eyes, all the way in, deep, real deep, in your fevered little brain, and twist them around. See if maybe I can unscramble whatever's messed up in there."
"Jesus, lady," Samson's partner said.
His name was Burdock. Beside anyone but Samson, he would have looked like a big man. "Well," she said, "he's too screwed up to get any help from a prison psychiatrist." Samson said, "Don't do anything foolish, Julie." Rasmussen glanced at her, meeting her eyes for only a second, but that was long enough for him to understand the depth of her anger and to be frightened by it. A flush of childish embarrassment and temper had accompanied his pout, but now his face went pale. To Samson, in a voice that was too shrill and quaverous to be as tough as he intended, Rasmussen said, "Keep this crazy bitch away from me!" "Well, she's not actually crazy," Samson said, "not clinically speaking, at least. Pretty hard to have anyone declared crazy these days. Lots of concern about their civil rights, you know. I wouldn't say she was crazy." Without looking away from Rasmussen, Julie said, "Thank you so much, Sam." "Well, you'll notice I didn't say anything about the other half of his accusation," Samson said good-naturedly. "Yeah, I got your point." While she talked to Samson, she kept her attention on Rasmussen. Everyone harbored a special fear, a private boogeyman built to his own specifications and crouched in a dark corner of his mind. And Julie knew what Tom Rasmussen feared more than anything else in the world. Not heights, not confining spaces, not crowds, cats, flying, insects, dogs, or darkness. Dakota and Dakota had developed a thick file on him in recent weeks, and had turned up the fact that he suffered from a phobia of blindness. In prison, every month with the regularity of a true obsessive, he had demanded an eye exam, claiming his vision was deteriorating. And he'd petitioned to be tested periodically for syphilis, diabetes, and other diseases that, untreated, could result in blindness. When not in prison, and he'd been there twice, he had a standing monthly appointment with an ophthalmologist in Costa Mesa. Still squatting in front of Rasmussen, Julie took hold of his chin. He flinched. She twisted his head toward her. She thrust two fingers of her other hand at him, raked them down his cheek, making red welts on his wan skin, but not hard enough to draw blood. He squealed and tried to strike her with his cuffed hands, but he was inhibited by both his fear and the chain that tethered his wrists to his ankles.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
She spread the same two fingers with which she'd scratched him, and now she poked them at him, stopping just 2 inches short of his eyes. He winced, made a mewling sound, and tried to pull loose of her, but she held him fast by the chin, forcing a confrontation. "Me and Bobby have been together 8 years, married more than 7, and they've been the best years of my life, but you come along and think you can just squash him the way you'd squash a bug." She slowly brought her fingertips closer to his eyes, 1.5 inches, 1 inch. Rasmussen tried to pull back. His head was against the wall. He had nowhere to go. The sharp tips of her manicured fingernails were less than 1/2 inch from his eyes.
"This police brutality,"
Rasmussen said. "I'm not a cop," Julie said.
"They are,"
he said, rolling his eyes at Sampson and Burdock.
"Even to get this bitch away from me, I'll sue your asses off."
With her fingernails, she flicked his eyelashes. His attention snapped back to her. He was breathing fast, and suddenly he was sweating, too. She flicked his lashes again and smiled. The dark pupils of his yellow-brown eyes were wide open.
"You bastards better hear me. I swear. I'll sue. They'll kick you off the force."
She flicked his lashes again. He closed his eyes tight.
"They'll take away your goddamn uniforms and badges. They'll throw you in prison. And you know what happens to ex-cops in prison? They get the shit kicked out of them, broken, killed, raped."
His voice spiraled up, cracked on that last word, like the voice of an adolescent boy. Glancing at Sampson, to be sure she had his tacit, if not active, approval to carry this just a little further. Glancing also at Burdock, and seeing that he was not as placid as Sampson, but would probably stay out of it for a while yet, Julie pressed her fingernails against Rasmussen's eyelids. He attempted to squeeze his eyes even more tightly shut. She pressed harder. "You tried to take Bobby away from me, so I'll take your eyes away from you."
"You're nuts!"
She pressed still harder.
"Make her stop!"
Rasmussen demanded of the two cops. "If you don't want me to have my Bobby to look at, why should I let you look at anything ever again?"
"What do you want?"
Perspiration poured down Rasmussen's face. He looked like a candle in a bonfire, melting fast. "Who gave you permission to kill Bobby?"
"Permission? What do you mean? Nobody. I don't need—"
"You wouldn't have tried to touch him if your employer hadn't told you to do it."
"I knew he was on to me,"
Rasmussen said frantically. And because she had not let up the pressure with her nails, thin tears flowed from under his eyelids.
"I knew he was out there. Tumbled to him 5, 6 days ago. Even though he used different vans and trucks, even that orange van from the county seal on it. I had to do something, didn't I? I couldn't walk away from the job. Too much money at stake. I couldn't let him just nail me when I finally got wizard. So I had to do something. Listen, Jesus, it was as simple as that."
"You're just a computer freak. A hired hacker. Morally bent, sleazy, but you're no tough guy. You're soft, squishy soft. You wouldn't plan a hit on your own. Your boss told you to do it."
"I don't have a boss. I'm freelance."
"Somebody still pays you." She risked more pressure, not with the points of her nails, but with the flat surfaces. Although Rasmussen was so swept away by a rapture of fear that he might still imagine he could feel those filed edges gradually carving through the delicate shields of his eyelids. He must be seeing interior star fields now, bursts and whorls of color. And maybe he was feeling some pain. He was shaking. His shackles clinked and rattled. More tears squeezed from beneath his lids.
Delafield!
The word erupted from him as if he had been trying simultaneously to hold it back and to expel it with all his might.
Kevin Delafield!
Who's he? Julie asked, still holding Rasmussen's chin with one hand, her fingernails against his eyes unrelenting.
Microcrest Corporation.
That's who hired you for this? He was rigid, afraid to move a fraction of an inch, convinced that the slightest shift in his position would force her fingernails into his eyes.
Yeah. Delafield. A nutcase. A renegade. They don't understand about him at Microcrest. They just know he gets results for him. When this hits the fan, they'll be surprised by it, blown away. So let go of me. What more do you want?
She let go of him. Immediately, he opened his eyes, blinked, testing his vision, then broke down and sobbed with relief. As Julie stood, the nearby elevator door opened and Bobby returned with the officer who had accompanied him downstairs to Aykroyd's office. Bobby looked at Rasmussen, cocked his head at Julie, clucked his tongue and said, "You've been naughty, haven't you, dear? Can't I take you anywhere?"
"Oh, I just had a conversation with Mr. Rasmussen, that's all."
"Well, he seems to have found it stimulating," Bobby said. Rasmussen sat slumped forward, with his hands over his eyes, weeping uncontrollably.
"We disagreed about something," Julie said.
"Movies? Books?
Music?"
"Ah." Samson Garfus spoke softly. "You're a wild woman, Julie." "He tried to have Bobby killed," was all she said. Samson nodded. "I'm not saying I don't admire wildness sometimes, a little, but you sure as hell owe me one." "I do," she agreed. "You owe me more than one," Burdock said. "This guy's going to file a complaint. You can bet your ass on it."
"Complaint about what?" Julie asked.
"He's not even marked." Already the faint welts on Rasmussen's cheeks were fading. Sweat, tears, and a case of the shakes were the only evidence of his ordeal. "Listen," Julie told Burdock. "He cracked because I just happened to know exactly the right weak point where I could give him a little tap, like cutting a diamond. It worked because scum like him thinks everyone else is scum, too. Thinks we're capable of doing what he'd do in the same situation. I'd never put his eyes out. But he might have put mine out if our roles were reversed. So he thought for sure I'd do him like he would have done me. All I did was use his own screwed-up attitudes against him. Psychology. Nobody can file a complaint about the application of a little psychology." She turned to Bobby and said, "What was on those diskettes?"
"Wizard.
Not trash data. The whole thing. These have to be the files he duplicated. He only made one set while I was watching, and after the shooting started, he didn't have time to make backup copies." The elevator bell rang, and their floor number lit on the board. When the doors opened, a plainclothes detective they knew, Gil Daner, stepped into the hallway. Julie took the package of diskettes from Bobby, handed them to Daner. She said, "This is evidence. The whole case might rest on it. You think you can keep track of it?" Daner grinned. "Gotch, ma'am. I'll try."
Frank Pollard, alias James Roman, alias George Ferris, looked in the trunk of the stolen Chevy and found a small bundle of tools wrapped in a felt pouch and tucked in the wheel well. He used a screwdriver to take the plates off the car. Half an hour later, after cruising some of the higher and even more quiet neighborhoods in Fogbond Laguna, he parked on a dark side street and exchanged the Chevy's plates for those on an Oldsmobile. With luck, the owner of the Olds would not notice the new plates for a couple of days, maybe even a week or longer. Until he reported the switch, the Chevy would not match anything on a police hot sheet and would therefore be relatively safe to drive. In any case, Frank intended to get rid of the car by tomorrow night and either boost a new one or use some of the cash in the flight bag to buy legal wheels. Though he was exhausted, he didn't think it wise to check into a motel. 4:30 in the morning was a damned odd hour for anyone to be wanting a room. Furthermore, he was unshaven, and his thick hair was matted and oily, and both his jeans and checkered blue flannel shirt were dirty and rumpled from his recent adventures. The last thing he wanted to do was call attention to himself, so he decided to catch a few hours of sleep in the car. He drove farther south into Laguna Niguel, where he parked on a quiet residential street, under the immense boughs of a date palm. He stretched out on the back seat as comfortably as possible, without benefit of sufficient legroom or pillows, and closed his eyes. For the moment he was not afraid of his unknown pursuer, because he felt that the man was no longer nearby. Temporarily, at least, he had given his enemy the shake, and had no need to lie awake in fear of a hostile face suddenly appearing at the window. He was also able to put out of his mind all questions about his identity and the money in the flight bag. He was so tired, and his thought processes were so fuzzy, that any attempt to puzzle out solutions to those mysteries would be fruitless. He was kept awake, however, by the memory of how strange the events in Anaheim had been a few hours ago. The foreboding gusts of wind, the eerie flute-like music, imploding windows, exploding tires, failed brakes, failed steering. Who had come into that apartment behind the blue light? Was who the right word? Or would it be more accurate to ask what had been searching for him? During his urgent flight from Anaheim to Laguna, he'd not had the leisure to reflect upon those bizarre incidents. But now he could not turn his mind from them. He sensed that he had survived an encounter with something unnatural. Worse, he sensed that he knew what it was, and that his amnesia was self-induced by a deep desire to forget. After a while, even the memory of those preternatural events wasn't enough to keep him awake. The last thing that crossed his waking mind as he slipped off on a tide of sleep was that four-word phrase that had come to him when he had first awakened in the deserted alleyway. Fireflies in a windstorm.
By the time they had cooperated with the police at the scene, made arrangements for their disabled vehicles, and talked with the three corporate officers who showed up at Decadine, Bobby and Julie did not get home until shortly before dawn. They were dropped at their door by a police cruiser, and Bobby was glad to see the place. They lived on the east side of Orange, in a three-bedroom sort of ersatz Spanish tract house, which they had bought new 2 years ago, largely for its investment potential. Even at night, the relative youth of the neighborhood was apparent in the landscaping. None of the shrubbery had reached full size. The trees were still too immature to loom higher than the rain gutters on the houses. Bobby unlocked the door, Julie went in, and he followed. The sound of their footsteps on the parquet floor of the foyer, echoing hollowly off the bare walls of the adjacent and utterly empty living room, was proof that they were not committed to the house for the long term. To save money toward the fulfillment of the dream, they had left the living room, dining room, and two bedrooms unfurnished. They installed cheap carpet and cheaper draperies. Not a penny had been spent on other improvements. This was merely a way station, en route to the dream, so they saw no point in lavishing funds on the decor. The dream. That was how they thought of it, with a capital T and a capital D. They kept their expenses as low as possible in order to fund the dream. They didn't spend much on clothes or vacations, and they didn't buy fancy cars. With hard work and iron determination, they were building Dakota and Dakota Investigations into a major firm that could be sold for a large capital gain. So they plowed a lot of earnings back into the business to make it grow for the dream. At the back of the house, the kitchen and family room and the small breakfast area that separated them were furnished. This and the master bedroom upstairs was where they lived when at home. The kitchen had a Spanish tile floor, beige counters, and dark oak cabinets. No money had been spent on decorative accessories, but the room had a cozy feeling because some necessities of a functioning kitchen were on display. A net bag filled with a half a dozen onions, copper pots dangling from a ceiling rack, cooking utensils, bottles of spices. Three green tomatoes were ripening on the windowsill. Julie leaned against the counter as if she could not stand another moment without support. And Bobby said, "You want a drink?" "Booze at dawn?" "Oh, I was thinking more of milk or juice." "No, thanks." "Hungry?" She shook her head. "I just want to fall into bed. I'm beat." He took her in his arms, held her close, cheek to cheek, with his face buried in her hair. Her arms tightened around him. They stood that way for a while, saying nothing, letting the residual fear evaporate in the gentle heat they generated between them. Fear and love were indivisible. If you allowed yourself to care, to love, you made yourself vulnerable, and vulnerability led to fear. He found meaning in life through his relationship with her. And if she died, meaning and purpose would die too. With Julie still in his arms, Bobby leaned back and studied her face. The smudges of dried blood had been wiped away. The skinned spot on her forehead was beginning to scab over with a thin yellow membrane. However, the imprint of their recent ordeal consisted of more than the abrasion on her forehead. With her tan complexion, she could never be said to look pale, even in moments of the most profound anxiety. A detectable grayness seeped into her face, however, at times like this, and at the moment her cinnamon and cream skin was underlaid with a shade of gray that made him think of headstone marble. "It's over," he assured her. "We're okay." "It's not over in my dreams. It won't be for weeks. A thing like tonight adds to the legend of Dakota and Dakota. I don't want to be a legend. Legends are all dead. We'll be living legends, and that'll bring in business. The more business we build, the sooner we can sell out, grab the dream." He kissed her gently on each corner of her mouth. "I have to call in, leave a long message on the agency machine, so Clint will know how to handle everything when he goes to work." "Yeah, I don't want the phone to start ringing only a couple of hours after I've hit the sheets." He kissed her again and went to the wall phone beside the refrigerator. As he was dialing the office number, he heard Julie walk to the bathroom off the short hall that connected the kitchen to the laundry room. She closed the bathroom door. Just as the answering machine picked up, "Thank you for calling Dakota and Dakota. No one..." Clint Karagiosis, whose Greek-American family had been fans of Clint Eastwood from the earliest days of his first television show, Rawhide, was Bobby and Julie's right-hand man in the office. He could be trusted to handle any problem. Bobby left a long message for him, summarizing the events at Decadyne and noting specific tasks that had to be done to wrap up the case. When he hung up, he stepped down into the adjoining family room, switched on the CD player, and put on a Benny Goodman disc. The first notes of King Porter Stomp brought the dead room to life. In the kitchen again, he got a quart can of eggnog from the refrigerator. They had bought it 2 weeks ago for their quiet, at-home New Year's Eve celebration, but had not opened it after all on the holiday. He opened it now and half-filled two water glasses. From the bathroom, he heard Julie make a tortured sound. She was finally throwing up. It was mostly just dry heaves because they had not eaten in 8 or 10 hours, but the spasms sounded violent. Throughout the night, Bobby had expected her to succumb to nausea, and he was surprised that she had retained control of herself this long. He retrieved a bottle of white rum from the bar cabinet in the family room and spiked each serving of eggnog with a double shot. He was gently stirring the drinks with a spoon to blend in the rum when Julie returned, looking even grayer than before. When she saw what he was doing, she said, "I don't need that. I know what you need. I'm psychic. I knew you'd toss your cookies after what happened tonight. Now I know you need this." He stepped to the sink and rinsed off the spoon. "No, Bobby, really, I can't drink that." The Goodman music didn't seem to be energizing her. "It'll settle your stomach, and if you don't drink it, you're not going to sleep." Taking her by the arm, crossing the breakfast area, and stepping down into the family room, he said, "You'll lie awake, worrying about me, worrying about Thomas," Thomas was her brother, "about the world, and everyone in it." They sat on the sofa, and he did not turn on any lamps. The only light was what reached them from the kitchen. She drew her legs under her and turned slightly to face him. Her eyes shone with a soft, reflected light. She sipped the eggnog. The room was now filled with the strains of One Sweet Letter from You, one of Goodman's most beautiful thematic statements, with a vocal by Louise Tobin. They sat and listened for a while. Then Julie said, "I'm tough, Bobby, I really am." "I know you are. I don't want you thinking I'm lame. Never. It wasn't the shooting that made me sick. Or using the Toyota to run that guy down. Even though the thought of almost losing you... I know, I know. It was what you had to do to Rasmussen. Well, he's a slimy little weasel-faced bastard, but even he doesn't deserve to be broken like that. What I did to him stank. It was the only way to crack the case, because it wasn't near cracked till we'd found out who hired him. She drank more eggnog. She frowned down at the milky contents of her glass, as if the answer to some mystery could be found there. Following Tobin's vocal, Ziggy Ellman came in with a lusty trumpet solo, followed by Goodman's clarinet. The sweet sounds made that boxy, tract house room seem like the most romantic place in the world. What I did for the dream. Giving Decadine Rasmussen's employer will please them, but breaking him was somehow, oh, worse than wasting a man in a fair gunfight. Bobby put one hand on her knee. It was a nice knee. After all these years, he was still sometimes surprised by her slenderness and the delicacy of her bone structure, for he always thought of her as being strong for her size, solid, indomitable. If you hadn't put Rasmussen in that vise and squeezed him, I would have done it. No, you wouldn't have. You're scrappy, Bobby, and you're smart, and you're tough. But there are certain things you can never do. This was one of them. Don't jive me just to make me feel good. You're right, he said. I couldn't have done it. But I'm glad you did. Decadine's very big time. And this could have set us back years if we'd flubbed it. Is there anything we won't do for the dream? Bobby said, sure. We wouldn't torture small children with red-hot knives. And we wouldn't shove innocent old ladies down long flights of stairs. And we wouldn't club a basket full of newborn puppies to death with an iron bar. At least not without good reason. Her laughter lacked a full measure of humor. Listen, he said. You're a good person. You've got a good heart. And nothing you did to Rasmussen blackens it at all. I hope you're right. It's a hard world sometimes. Another drink will soften it a little. You know the calories in these? I'll be as fat as a hippo. Hippos are cute, he said, taking her glass and heading back toward the kitchen to pour another drink. I love hippos. Well, you won't want to make love to one. Sure. More to hold, more to love. You'd be crushed. Well, of course, I'll always insist on taking the top.
Candy was going to kill. He stood in the dark living room of a stranger's house, shaking with need. Blood. He needed blood. Candy was going to kill. And there was nothing he could do to stop himself, not even thinking of his mother, could shame him into controlling his hunger. His given name was James, but his mother, an unselfish soul, exceedingly kind, brimming with love, a saint, always said he was her little candy boy. Never James, never Jim or Jimmy. She'd said he was sweeter than anything on earth, and little candy boy eventually had become candy boy. And by the time he was six, the sobriquet had been shortened and capitalized, and he had become candy for good. Now at 29, that was the only name to which he would answer. Many people thought murder was a sin. He knew otherwise. Some were born with a taste for blood. God had made them what they were and expected them to kill chosen victims. It was all part of his mysterious plan. The only sin was to kill when God and your mother did not approve of the victim, which was exactly what he was about to do. He was ashamed, but he was also in need. He listened to the house. Silence. Like unearthly and dusky beasts, the shadowy forms of the living room furniture huddled around him. Breathing hard, trembling, Candy moved into the dining room, kitchen, family room, and then slowly along the hallway that led to the front of the house. He made no sound that would have alerted anyone asleep upstairs. He seemed to glide rather than walk, as if he were a specter instead of a real man. He paused at the foot of the stairs and made one last feeble attempt to overcome his murderous compulsion. Failing, he shuddered and let out his pent-up breath. He began to climb toward the second floor where the family was probably sleeping. His mother would understand and forgive him. She had taught him that killing was good and moral, but only when necessary, only when it benefited the family. She had been terribly angry with him on those occasions when he had killed out of sheer compulsion with no good reason. She'd had no need to punish him physically for his errant ways, because her displeasure gave him more agony than any punishment she could have devised. For days at a time, she refused to speak to him, and that silent treatment caused his chest to swell with pain, so it seemed as if his heart would spasm and cease to beat. She looked straight through him, too, as if he no longer existed. When the other children spoke of him, she said, "Oh, you mean your late brother, Candy, your poor dead brother. Well, remember him if you want, but only among yourselves, not to me, never to me, because I don't want to remember him, not that bad seed. He was no good, that one, no good at all, wouldn't listen to his mother, not him, always thought he knew better. Just the sound of his name makes me sick, revolts me, so don't mention him in my hearing." Each time that Candy had been temporarily banished to the land of the dead for having misbehaved, no place was set for him at the table, and he had to stand in a corner watching the others eat, as if he was a visiting spirit. She would not favor him with either a frown or a smile, and she would not stroke his hair or touch his face with her warm, soft hands, and she would not let him cuddle against her or put his weary head upon her breast. And at night he had to find his way into a troubled sleep without being guided there by either her bedtime stories or sweet lullabies. In that total banishment, he learned more of hell than he ever hoped to know. But she would understand why Candy could not control himself tonight, and she'd forgive him. Sooner or later, she always forgave him, because her love for him was like the love of God for all his children, perfect, rich with forbearance and mercy. When she deemed that Candy had suffered enough, she always had looked at him again, smiled for him, opened her arms wide. In her new acceptance of him, he had experienced as much of heaven as he needed to know. She was in heaven now, herself, 7 long years. God, how he missed her. But she was watching him even now. She would know he had lost control tonight, and she would be disappointed in him. He climbed the stairs, rushing up 2 risers at a time, staying close to the wall where the steps were less likely to squeak. He was a big man, but graceful and light on his feet, and if some of the stair treads were loose or tired with age, they did not creak under him. In the upstairs hall, he paused, listening. Nothing. A dim nightlight was part of the overhead smoke alarm. The glow was just bright enough for Candy to see 2 doors on the right of the hall, 2 on the left, and 1 at the far end. He crept to the first door on the right, eased it open, and slipped into the room beyond. He closed the door again and stood with his back to it. Although his need was great, he forced himself to wait for his eyes to adjust to the gloom. Ashen light from a street lamp at least 1/2 a block away glimmered faintly at the 2 windows. He noticed the mirror first, a frosty rectangle in which the meager radiance was murkily reflected. Then he began to make out the shape of the dresser beneath it. A moment later he was also able to see the bed and dimly the huddled form of someone lying under a light-colored blanket that was vaguely phosphorescent. Candy stepped cautiously to the bed, took hold of the blanket and sheets, and hesitated, listening to the soft, rhythmic breathing of the sleeper. He detected a trace of perfume mingled with a pleasant scent of warm skin and recently shampooed hair. A girl. He could always tell girl smell from boy smell. He also sensed that this one was young, perhaps a teenager. If his need had not been so intense, he would have hesitated much longer than he did, for the moments preceding a kill were exciting, almost better than the act itself. With a dramatic flick of his arm, as if he were a magician throwing back the cloth that had covered an empty cage to reveal a captive dove of sorcerous origins, he uncovered the sleeper. He fell upon her, crushing her into the mattress with his body. She woke instantly and tried to scream, even though he had surely knocked the wind out of her. Fortunately, he had unusually large and powerful hands, and he had found her face, even as she began to raise her voice. So he was able to thrust his palm under her chin and hook his fingers in her cheeks and clamp her mouth shut. "Be quiet or I'll kill you," he whispered, his lips brushing against her delicate ear. Making a muffled, panicky sound, she squirmed under him, though to no avail. Judging by the feel of her, she was a girl, not a woman. Perhaps no younger than 12, certainly no older than 15. She was no match for him.
"I don't want to hurt you. I just want you. And when I'm done with you, I'll leave."
That was a lie, for he had no desire to rape her. Sex was of no interest to him. Indeed, sex disgusted him, involving unmentionable fluids. Depending upon the shameless use of the same organs associated with urination, sex was an unspeakably repulsive act. Other people's fascination with it only proved to Candy that men and women were members of a fallen species, and that the world was a cesspool of sin and madness. Either because she believed his pledge not to kill her, or because she was now half paralyzed with fear, she stopped resisting. Maybe she just needed all of her energy to breathe. Candy's full weight, 220 pounds, was pressing on her chest, restricting her lungs. Against his hand, with which he clamped her mouth shut, he could feel her cool inhalations as her nostrils flared, followed by short, hot exhalations. His vision had continued to adapt to the poor light. Although he still could not make out the details of her face, he could see her eyes shining darkly in the gloom, glistening with terror. He could also see that she was a blonde. Her pale hair caught even the dull gray glow from the windows and shone with burnished silver highlights. With his free hand, he gently pushed her hair back from the right side of her neck. He shifted his position slightly, moving down on her in order to bring his lips to her throat. He kissed the tender flesh, felt the strong throb of her pulse against his lips, then bit deep and found the blood. She bucked and thrashed beneath him, but he held her down and held her fast, and she could not dislodge his greedy mouth from the wound he had made. He swallowed rapidly, but could not consume the thick, sweet fluid as fast as it was offered. Soon, however, the flow diminished. The girl's convulsions became less violent as well, then faded altogether, until she was as still beneath him as if she had been nothing more than a tangled mound of bedclothes. He rose from her and switched on the bedside lamp just long enough to see her face. He always wanted to see their faces after their sacrifices, if not before. He also liked to look into their eyes, which seemed not sightless, but gifted with a vision of the far place to which their souls had gone. He did not entirely understand his curiosity. After all, when he ate a steak, he did not wonder what the cow had looked like. This girl, and each of the others on whom he'd fed, should have been nothing more than one of the cattle to him. Once, in a dream, when he had finished drinking from a ravaged throat, his victim, although dead, had spoken to him, asking him why he wanted to look upon her in death. When he had said that he didn't know the answer to her question, she had suggested that perhaps on those occasions, when he had killed in the dark, he later needed to see his victims' faces because, in some unlit corner of his heart, he half expected to find his own face looking up at him, ice-white and dead-eyed. "Deep down," the dream victim had said, "deep down you know that you're already dead yourself, burned out inside. You realize that you have far more in common with your victims after you've killed them than before." Those words, although spoken only in a dream and though amounting to the purest nonsense, had nevertheless brought him awake with a sharp cry. He was alive, not dead, powerful and vital, a man with appetites as strong as they were unusual. The dream victim's words stayed with him over the years, and when they echoed through his memory at times like this, they made him anxious. Now, as always, he refused to dwell on them. He turned his attention instead to the girl on the bed. She appeared to be about 14, quite pretty. Captivated by her flawless complexion, he wondered if her skin would feel as perfect as it looked, as smooth as porcelain, if he dared to stroke it with his fingertips. Her lips were slightly parted, as if they had been gently prized open by her spirit as it departed her. Her wonderfully blue, clear eyes seemed enormous, too big for her face, and as wide as a winter sky. He would have liked to gaze upon her for hours. Letting a sigh of regret escape him, he switched off the lamp. He stood for a while in the darkness, enveloped by the pungent aroma of blood. When his eyes had readjusted to the gloom, he returned to the hall, not bothering to close the girl's door behind him. He entered the room across from hers and found it untenanted. But in the room next to that one, Candy smelled a trace of stale sweat and heard snoring. This one was a boy, 17 or 18, not a big kid, but not small either, and he put up more of a struggle than his sister. However, he was sleeping on his stomach, and when Candy threw back the covers and fell upon him, the boy's face was jammed hard into the pillow and mattress, smothering him and making it difficult for him to shout a warning. The fight was violent, but brief. The boy passed out from lack of oxygen, and Candy flopped him over. When he went for the exposed throat, Candy let out a low and eager cry that was louder than any sound the boy had made. Later, when he opened the door to the fourth bedroom, the first pewter light of dawn had pierced the windows. Shadows still huddled in the corners, but the deeper darkness had been chased off. The early light was too thin to elicit color from objects, and everything in the room seemed to be one shade of gray or another. An attractive blonde, in her late 30s, was asleep on one side of a king-size bed. The sheets and blanket on the other half of the bed were hardly disturbed, so he figured the woman's husband had either moved out or was away on business. He noted a half-full glass of water and a plastic bottle of prescription drugs on the nightstand. He picked up the pharmacy bottle and saw that it was 2/3 full of small pills, a sedative, according to the label. From the label, he also learned her name, Roseanne Lofton. Candy stood for a while, staring down at her face, and an old longing for maternal solace stirred in him. Need continued to drive him, but he did not want to take her violently, did not want to rip her open and drain her in a few minutes. He wanted this one to last. He had the urge to suckle on this woman as he had suckled on his mother's blood, when she would permit him that grace. Occasionally, when he was in her favor, his mother would make a shallow cut in the palm of her hand, or puncture one of her fingers, then allow him to curl up against her and be nursed on her blood for an hour or longer. During that time, a great peace stole over him, a bliss so profound that the world and all its pain ceased to be real to him, because his mother's blood was like no other, untainted, pure as the tears of a saint. Through such small wounds, of course, he was able to drink no more than an ounce or two of her, but that meager dribble was more precious and more nourishing to him than the gallons he might have drained from a score of other people. The woman before him would not have such ambrosia within her veins, but if he closed his eyes while he suckled on her, and if he let his mind reel backward to memories of the days before his mother's death, he might recapture at least some of the exquisite serenity he had known then, and experience a faint echo of that old thrill. At last, without casting the covers aside, Candy gently lowered himself to the bed and stretched out beside the woman, watching as her heavy-lidded eyes fluttered and then opened. She blinked at him as he cuddled next to her, and for a moment she seemed to think that she was still dreaming, for no expression tightened the muscles of her slack face. "All I want is your blood," he said softly. Abruptly, she cast off the lingering effects of the sedative, and her eyes filled with alarm. Before she could spoil the beauty of the moment by screaming or resisting, thereby shattering the illusion that she was his mother and was giving voluntarily of herself, he struck the side of her neck with his heavy fist. Then he struck her again. Then he hammered the side of her face twice. She slumped unconscious against the pillow. He squirmed under the covers to be close against her, withdrew her hand, and nipped her palm with his teeth. He put his head on the pillow, lying face to face with her, holding her hand between them, drinking the slow trickle from her palm. He closed his eyes after a while and tried to imagine that she was his mother. And eventually, a gratifying peace stole over him. However, though he was happier at that moment than he had been in a long time, it was not a deep happiness, merely a veneer of joy that brightened the surface of his heart but left the inner chambers dark and cold. After only a few hours of sleep, Frank Pollard woke in the back seat of the stolen Chevy. The morning sun streaming through the windows was bright enough to make him wince. He was stiff, achy, and unrested. His throat was dry and his eyes burned as if he had not slept for days. Groaning, Frank swung his legs off the seat, sat up, and cleared his throat. He realized that both of his hands were numb. They felt cold and dead, and he saw that he had curled them into fists. He had evidently been sleeping that way for some time, because at first he could not unclench. With considerable effort, he opened his right fist, and a handful of something black and grainy poured through his tingling fingers. He stared, perplexed at the fine grains that had spilled down the leg of his jeans and onto his right shoe. He raised his hand to take a closer look at the residue that had stuck to his palm. It looked and smelled like sand. Black sand? Where had he gotten it? When he opened his left hand, more sand spilled out. Confused, he looked through the car windows at the residential neighborhood around him. He saw green lawns, dark topsoil showing through where the grass was sparse, mulch-filled planting beds, redwood chips mounded around some shrubs, but nothing like what he had held in his tightly clenched fists. He was in Laguna Niguel, so the Pacific Ocean was nearby, rimmed by broad beaches, but those beaches were white, not black. As full circulation returned to his cramped fingers, he leaned back in the seat, raised his hands in front of his face, and stared at the black grains that speckled his sweat-damp skin. Sand, even black sand, was a humble and innocent substance. But the residue on his hands troubled him as deeply as if it had been fresh blood. "Who the hell am I? What's happening to me?" he wondered aloud. He knew that he needed help, but he didn't know to whom he could turn.
Bobby was awakened by a Santa Ana wind soughing in the trees outside. It whistled under the eaves and forced a chorus of ticks and creaks from the cedar shingle roof and the attic rafters. He blinked sleep-matted eyes and squinted at the numbers on the bedroom ceiling, 1207. Because they sometimes worked odd hours and slept during the day, they had installed exterior Rolodex security shutters, leaving the room coal mine dark except for the projection clock's pale green numerals, which floated on the ceiling like some portentous spirit message from beyond. Because he had gone to bed near dawn and instantly to sleep, he knew the numbers on the ceiling meant that it was shortly past noon, not midnight. He had slept perhaps 6 hours. He lay unmoving for a moment, wondering if Julie was awake. She said, "I am." "You're spooky," he said. "You knew what I was thinking." "That's not spooky," she said. "That's married." He reached for her, and she came into his arms. For a while, they just held each other, satisfied to be close. But by mutual and unspoken desire, they began to make love. The projection clock's glowing green numerals were too pale to relieve the absolute darkness, so Bobby could see nothing of Julie as they clung together. However, he saw her through his hands. As he reveled in the smoothness and warmth of her skin, the elegant curves of her breasts, the discovery of angularity precisely where angularity was desirable, the tautness of muscle, and the fluid movement of muscle and bone, he might have been a blind man using his hands to describe an inner vision of ideal beauty. The wind shook the world outside in sympathy with the climaxes that shook Julie. And when Bobby could withhold himself no longer, when he cried out and emptied himself into her, the skirling wind cried too, and a bird that had taken shelter in a nearby eave was blown from its perch with a rustle of wings and a spiraling shriek. For a while they lay side by side in the blackness, their breath mingling, touching each other almost reverently. They did not want or need to speak. Talk would have diminished the moment. The aluminum slat shutters vibrated softly in the huffing wind. Gradually, the afterglow of lovemaking gave way to a curious uneasiness, the source of which Bobby could not identify. The enveloping blackness began to seem oppressive, as if a continued absence of light was somehow contributing to a thickening of the air, until it would become viscid and unbreathable as syrup. Though he had just made love to her, he was stricken by the crazy notion that Julie was not actually there with him, that what he had coupled with was a dream, or the congealing darkness itself, and that she had been stolen from him in the night, whisked away by some power he could not fathom, and that she was forever beyond his reach. His childish fear made him feel foolish, but he rose onto one elbow and turned on one of the wall-mounted bedside lamps. When he saw Julie lying beside him, smiling, her head raised on a pillow, the level of his inexplicable anxiety abruptly dropped. He let out a rush of breath, surprised to discover that he'd pent it up in the first place. But a peculiar tension remained in him, and the sight of Julie, safe and undamaged, but for the scabbing spot on her forehead, was insufficient to completely relax him. "What's wrong?" she asked, as perceptive as ever. "Nothing," he lied. "Bit of a headache? From all that rum in the eggnog?" What troubled him was not a hangover, but the queer, unshakable feeling that he was going to lose Julie, that something out there in a hostile world was coming to take her away. As the optimist in the family, he wasn't usually given to grim forebodings of doom. Accordingly, this strange, augural chill frightened him more than it would have if he had been regularly subject to such disturbances. "Bobby?" she said, frowning. "Headache," he assured her. He leaned down and gently kissed her eyes, then again, forcing her to close them so she would not see his face and read the anxiety that he was unable to conceal. Later, after showering and dressing, they ate a hasty breakfast while standing at the kitchen counter, English muffins and raspberry jam, half a banana each and black coffee. By mutual agreement, they were not going to the office. A brief call to Clint Karagiosis confirmed that the wrap-up on the Decadine case was nearly completed, and that no business needed their urgent personal attention. Their Suzuki Samurai waited in the garage, and Bobby's spirits rose at the sight of it. The Samurai was a small sports truck with four-wheel drive. He had justified its purchase by pitching its dual nature, utilitarian and recreational, to Julie, especially noting its comparatively reasonable price tag. But in fact, he had wanted it because it was fun to drive. She had not been deceived, and she had gone for it because she, too, thought it was fun to drive. This time, she was willing to let him have the wheel when he suggested she drive. "I did enough driving last night," she said as she buckled herself into her shoulder harness. Dead leaves, twigs, a few scraps of paper, and less identifiable detritus whirled and tumbled along the windswept streets. Dust devils spun out of the east as the Santa Anas, named for the mountains out of which they arose, poured down through the canyons and across the arid, scrub-stubbled hills that Orange County's industrious developers had not yet graded and covered with thousands of nearly identical wood and stucco pieces of the California dream. Trees bent to the surging oceans of air that moved in powerful and erratic tides towards the real sea in the west. The previous night's fog was gone, and the day was so clear that from the hills, Catalina Island could be seen 26 miles off the Pacific's distant coast. Julie popped an Artie Shaw CD into the player, and the smooth melody and softly bouncing rhythms of Begin the Begin filled the car. The mellow saxophones of Les Robinson, Hank Freeman, Tony Pastor, and Ronnie Perry provided strange counterpoint to the chaos and dissonance of the Santa Ana winds. From Orange, Bobby drove south and west toward the beach cities, Newport, Corona del Mar, Laguna, Dana Point. He traveled as much as possible on those few of the urbanized county's blacktop byways that could still be called back roads. They even passed a couple of orange groves, with which the county had once been carpeted, but which had mostly fallen to the relentless advance of the tracts and malls. Julie became more talkative.